Today's Wednesday, March 10th, and you're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, at least 39 migrants died off the coast of Tunisia.
All those who died on Tuesday were from sub-Saharan African nations, according to a ministry spokesman.
Also, President Joe Biden to meet leaders of Japan, India, and Australia virtually.
Combating the global pandemic will be a focus of the virtual meeting between President Joe Biden and the leaders of Japan, India, and Australia.
Plus, UN report paints a bleak picture of human rights in Iran. These stories and more are next. At least 39 migrants died when two boats sank off Tunisia on Tuesday as they tried to cross the Mediterranean to the Italian island of Lampedusa, Tunisian Defense Ministry said. The ministry spokesman said the Coast Guard rescued 165 others and searches for more survivors are still ongoing off the coast of Sfax. All the dead migrants were from sub-Saharan Africa, he added. The coastline near the Tunisian port city of Sfax has become a major departure point for people fleeing conflict and poverty in Africa and the Middle East and seeking a better life in Europe. The U.S. House is set to pass a massive COVID-19 relief bill that will reshape the American economy and send billions of dollars in global health funding abroad. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson reports on the U.S. response to the pandemic as vaccinations ramp up around the country.
As vaccines hit the ground around the world and vaccination rates rise to 10% in the U.S., Democrats are moving to pass transformational legislation to fight the pandemic.
We are on the verge of sending a bill to the president that will help our nation crush the COVID pandemic. It will put more vaccines in arms, put more kids back safely in schools, put more money in people's pockets, and put more people back to work.
The $1.9 trillion aid bill will reshape the U.S. economy by providing the biggest anti-poverty aid in almost 100 years. Republicans have criticized the bill for addressing too many issues beyond the pandemic.
It's no exaggeration to say that the majority is using this crisis to pass their progressive policy wish list.
But some analysts say the very size of the aid package will have a significant effect, not just on the U.S., but also on the world economy.
This $1.9 trillion bill will boost the global economy by 1%. That's an extraordinary statement. If we can get out from underneath the pandemic, we can reopen our economy, we're going to have very high growth rates.
The bill also provides $11 billion in U.S. foreign assistance, aid that will stabilize COVID programs in developing nations and continue U.S. work with the International COVAX vaccine program. Health experts say funding vaccinations for Americans is not enough.
Viruses don't respect borders. If we continue a slow global rollout of the vaccine, it is entirely possible that strains will emerge elsewhere that threaten the efficacy of our current vaccines and possibly even render them useless.
This Biden-led legislation, the fifth aid package passed since the pandemic began, enjoys broad support among the American people, according to recent polls. But after Congress's record spending to address the pandemic, it wasn't an easy fight for that foreign aid.
It's an acknowledgement that fixing COVID within the United States boundaries and getting out from underneath the pandemic, reopening society, reopening the economy, will only be successful if it is done universally around the world. That we cannot be thinking as if we're some isolated island.
As soon as President Biden signs that legislation this week, many low- and middle-income Americans will receive $1,400 stimulus payments within a matter of days. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
U.S. President Joe Biden and the leaders of Japan, India, and Australia will meet virtually later this week for the summit of the Quadrilateral Security Dialogue. White House correspondent Patsy Widescawara has the story.
Combating the global pandemic will be a focus of the virtual meeting between President Joe Biden and the leaders of Japan, India, and Australia, a group known as the Quad. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki.
A range of issues, of course, will be discussed. We expect to be discussed, I should say, facing the global community, from the threat of COVID to economic cooperation, and of course, to the climate crisis.
The Quad is not a formal military alliance, but often seen as a counterweight to growing Chinese influence in the Asia-Pacific region. The Friday meeting will be the first leaders' summit since the Quad's establishment in 2007. Sheila A. Smith is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations.
All eyes are on how the Biden administration is going to be pursuing its Asia strategy. So this is a pretty big signal that this is a high priority for the new administration.
The leaders are expected to discuss China's aggressive vaccine diplomacy. Beijing has pledged almost half a billion shots worldwide, an effort that some say is intended to expand its political clout. The U.S. has not outlined plans to provide vaccines abroad, but has pledged $4 billion to COVAX, the U.N. mechanism for global vaccine distribution. J. Stephen Morrison is director of the Global Health Policy Center at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
We have not defined what volume of vaccines will become available for distribution to COVAX or distribution to friendly partner governments, but we have committed in principle to doing that.
India is reportedly urging other Quad members to invest in its vaccine production capacity to counter Chinese vaccine diplomacy. More details on the Quad's vaccine commitment is expected after Friday's meeting. Again, Sheila Smith of CFR.
And it will be done in a multilateral framework. Not just the Americans are going to do it, but as you saw, the commitment was through the WHO. We're coming back to a global response to the pandemic. So I think there's small incremental steps here, but I don't think they want to overreach until they get the COVID-19 situation in the United States a little bit more stabilized and under control.
The Quad is also expected to discuss China's military growth. The country is increasing its defense budget by 6.8% in 2021. Admiral Philip Davidson is head of the U.S. Indo-Pacific Command.
Absent a convincing deterrent, China will be emboldened to continue to take action to supplant the established rules-based international order and the values represented in our vision for a free and open Indo-Pacific.
China's $208 billion defense budget is a quarter of the U.S. figure, but four times larger than Japan's. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News.
Myanmar security forces surrounded hundreds of protesters at two places in Yangon on Wednesday, and the U.S. Embassy called for the force to withdraw. Police stormed a compound in Yangon housing railway staff who have joined civil disobedience protests against the military coup. Forces also surrounded hundreds of protesters in North Okalapa district in another part of the city, news media reports. Scores of people were arrested Wednesday. Thousands of protesters have taken to the streets across the country since the military ousted elected government on February 1st. VOA's Burmese service chief Tan Nguyen Tan spoke to International Edition Steve Miller about the ongoing protests.
Day to day, there's a lot of protests and people coming out despite of the brutal response by the regime. So basically, they keep showing that they are satisfaction or angry over the military takeover. Obviously, they don't want to live under the military dictatorship. This is a quite clear expression. At the same time, they are just simply, one thing is supporting what they call it CDM, the Civil Disobedient Movement, which they encourage people to not to go to work and then just to simply choke for administrative machineries. So these are the only broad strategy. But apart from that, we don't actually know clear. For example, like later on, there's some sort of organization or representative people called CRHP, Committee Representing Those Elected People from Aung San Suu Kyi Party. They form, but they gone under what I call underground, and they form kind of a parallel government style structure to lobby the West, and then also UN, and then start dealing with the West, those sympathetic countries, as a kind of authoritative organization.
Since so many countries have spoken out against the military action on February 1st that resulted in a coup, what has been the response by the military leadership in Myanmar to the international condemnation?
Nearly every country in the world denounced the military takeover, and then they call for the release of Aung San Suu Kyi and the president. From the beginning, the Burmese military try very much to portray them like they are acting legitimately under the current constitution. So they don't even call it is a military coup. They were just simply kind of maintaining status quo or kind of a situation inside, a chaotic situation inside Burma or something like that. So they continuously try to convince their point of view or their story abroad by trying to say that, you know, we are very much lenient toward kind of street protests. We are using civilian laws only for the minimize that casualties or something like that, that they try to convince. So they will continue doing that. And I also expecting that probably the whole world will be at the same time inside Burma, that protests will be dying down. And also the whole world will be looking at it in a different way to resolve that situation to get out from the kind of status quo. So this is the main strategy from the military. So they, for the other diplomatic angle, I don't see much of that Myanmar newly appointed foreign minister being so much active on that situation. It's better they've been talking with the ASEAN leader and also today Japanese foreign ministry. But at the same time, that the Myanmar military has hired kind of a lobby firm from a Canadian-American lobby firm to lobby the White House and the United States Congress about just to present a military point of view. And also they will try to use that China card. If the U.S. push too much on the military, that the military will be kind of getting closer to the China or something like that.
That's Tan Wing Tan, the VOA's Burmese service chief, speaking with my colleague, Steve Miller. The nightly internet shutdowns in Myanmar are part of a strategy employed by many governments worldwide in times of crisis, but they come with costs. VOA's Michelle Quinn reports.
Nighttime in Myanmar, the country enters a digital curfew. In the morning, people check their phones to see if the internet is on. Then thousands jump on Siphon, a circumvention app, to access sites such as Facebook, Twitter, and others, which the military junta has ordered blocked. From his office in Toronto, Canada, Michael Hull, president of Siphon, can see as people rush to get on Siphon's servers. Siphon works with media outlets such as VOA.
The number of occurrences is unprecedented. And then from our point of view, from Siphon's point of view, the number of people that are having to utilize the Siphon network even after the network is restored is a new phenomenon.
It's unclear why the Myanmar military government, which seized control on February 1, is conducting nightly internet shutdowns. Governments typically argue that an internet shutdown helps maintain security in a time of crisis. Since the takeover, Myanmar has erupted in protests, with dozens of protesters killed.
The problem is that all the internet stuff is just a kind of prelude to something else, prelude to greater crackdown, harsher use of force, you know, more detentions of peaceful protesters.
In 2020, there were 155 internet shutdowns in 29 countries, according to Access Now, a nonprofit digital rights group. While fewer than in the prior 2 years, the blockages are still damaging. India, with 109 shutdowns, mostly in Indian-administered Kashmir, had the highest number. In Belarus, the internet went down in the European nation for 61 hours in August after the presidential election. In addition to shutdowns, some governments are installing new censorship and surveillance capabilities on the network. Cambodia is setting up an internet gateway that critics say will give the government the ability to surveil and censor internet users. A U.S. State Department spokeswoman expressed concern.
You know, we have a significant amount of Khmer Americans who are here in the United States, and we want to ensure that they're able to freely speak to their family and their friends and relatives who are still back in the country.
In a place like Myanmar, internet shutdowns and blockages of social media sites come with economic costs and political risk.
But they're also just deeply unpopular. It's you know, they must really want to shut down the information flow because people rely on the internet.
Michelle Quinn, VOA News.
This is the Voice of America. Anti-government protesters in Lebanon are burning tires to block key roads, releasing dense pulls of smoke that rise above the capital to Beirut and other parts of the country. Lebanon is mired in the worst economic crisis in its modern history, and the situation has been exacerbated by pandemic restrictions and overwhelmed healthcare sector. Buckingham Palace says allegations of racism made earlier this week by Prince Harry and Meghan were, quote, concerning, unquote, and will be addressed privately by the royal family. The comments made in a statement issued Tuesday on behalf of Queen Elizabeth II are the first from the palace since a two-hour TV interview by Harry and Meghan rocked the royal family. You are listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofo, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Kenya's ambassador to South Korea, Mwende Mwinzi, is facing threats of recall from her post by parliament over questions about her dual citizenship. Parliament demanded she renounce her American citizenship, but her lawyers say she became an American by birth and not naturalization, which qualifies her under the Constitution. Analysts say the outcome may determine if dual citizens who cannot opt out of the requirement can hold public office in the country. For more, I reached Tom Ojienda, the attorney from Mwinzi, on the controversy.
The fact that she holds a dual citizenship of the United States of America and of Kenya, Parliament then had a concern about her allegiance to Kenya and therefore was questioning whether the event of conflict between her interests in the U.S. and other interests of where she serves in Korea, whether she would do allegiance. And these are questions she responded to in Parliament. And she did confirm that she owes allegiance to Kenya and that those particular questions of conflict do not arise or have not arisen at all. We had a court intervention. We went to court. And the High Court, Justice Makau, did point to the fact that a dual citizen by birth and not by choice cannot be compelled to renounce a citizenship.
Local media is reporting that several members of parliament also have dual citizenship. Why do you think the ambassador is being singled out?
This is political. It's beyond my understanding. I do not know why they would single out Mwende Mwinzi for this discrimination. But also, we know that there are even Kenyans who serve as consulars for other states. They are Kenyans, but they are serving interests of other nations. And while they sit in Kenya, I know a number of Kenyan citizens who are heading foreign missions in Kenya for other countries. I do not understand what the concern is and why Mwende Mwinzi is singled out. There are many dual citizens who hold public office, and I don't understand why her case seems to take a different turn. I think we'll be asking the court to put a final mark on this question so that she does not go through the tragedy that she's going through.
She is a sitting ambassador of Kenya to South Korea. Do you think Parliament has the powers to recall her?
The question of an individual who is already serving and appointed is no longer a question for the institutions of the country. It is His Excellency the President that has made the final appointment and posting, and that is for us an act of finality. And that is what the individuals who have come to us to go to court are saying, that this is no longer a Mwende Mwinzi question. This is a question for Kenya as a country, because she's already appointed and serving, and not for institutions in the country to come questioning processes that are already done, because it's completely unfair. And I'll tell you this. This is an affront and looks a bit personal to Mwende Mwinzi. And let me say that exactly the president has done the correct thing.
Your legal options. Where are you at the moment, and what do you intend to do?
What I intend to do is very simple. I have dual citizens and other actors from the civil society, the organizations who have instructed me to put in a further case in court, which I shall be doing tomorrow morning. So we are on course on all this. We shall protect and ensure that we exhaust this process up to the Supreme Court.
That's Tom Ojienda, attorney for Kenya's ambassador to South Korea, Mwende Mwinzi, speaking from Nairobi. A UN report on the human rights situation in Iran presents a bleak picture of a society living under a system of brutal political repression and rampant violations of fundamental freedoms. The report has been submitted to the UN Human Rights Council. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
In his presentation to the Council, UN Special Rapporteur on the Situation of Human Rights in Iran, Javed Rehman, did not mince his words. He urged the international community to make Iran accountable for perpetrating what he called the most egregious violations with impunity.
It is beyond belief that almost 18 months since the deadly crackdown against the November 2019 protests in Iran, the government has still not conducted a proper investigation, nor held anyone accountable for the lethal force used against protesters, which caused at least 304 deaths.
Instead of investigating these crimes, Rahman noted, families seeking justice for relatives killed have been threatened by state agents. He suggested the reality of life in Iran is those who are innocent are punished, while the guilty go free. He cited a long list of violations, including Iran's high death penalty rate. He noted at least 267 executions took place last year, including several children. So far this year, more than 40 people reportedly have been put to death, many, he said, on the basis of torture-induced confessions as evidence. Iranian ambassador to the UN in Geneva, Ismail Baghaei Hamenei, called the report one-sided and said it is based on disinformation.
For more than 10 years now, this particular interactive debate has been used as a platform to launch a rhetorical campaign against Iran under the guise of human rights. The way human rights discourses are framed and weaponized by a certain group of states to score points in their political conflicts against their adversaries should be a matter of serious concern.
The Iranian ambassador said the establishment of a special rapporteur on Iran's human rights lacks any legitimate grounds. He added it was not fair or justified and should be abandoned. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
With the Kremlin cutting deals to ship its Sputnik V vaccine to countries struggling to combat the coronavirus, Russia's soft power is on display. But the global outreach campaign is happening amid signs the government is struggling to inoculate its own population at home. For VOA from Moscow, Charles Mains reports.
In the global battle against COVID-19, Russia's Sputnik V has emerged as a key choice among countries scrambling for access to life-saving vaccines. A glitzy social media campaign by its manufacturer backs the push.
So today is a great victory. Victory not just for Russia, but for the whole world as we are fighting the pandemic. And we use this V sign to celebrate our victory.
Sputnik V appears to have defied early skeptics. A recent independent review showed the vaccine with an efficacy rate of over 90%. It's a triumph of Russian soft power, say some observers, so long as the Kremlin manages to keep geopolitics out of the way. Russia's unique vaccine diplomacy has been particularly on display in Latin America. Russia has promised millions of doses to much fanfare. That the deals come across the backdrop of American drug manufacturers struggling to meet their own export quotas to the region only adds geopolitical dividends, say leading area experts. Vaccines are widely available in Moscow, but distribution to Russia's heartland presents a more complicated picture. Charles Mains for VOA News, Moscow.
Flying insects destroy billions of dollars of crops grown around the world each year, yet farmers who choose not to use pesticides often struggle to protect their plants. But as VOA's Arash Arabasadi reports, a Dutch startup company aims to help.
Nighttime in the Netherlands. A hunter drone takes flight with its sights set on an intruder. Its target, one of the many moths that threatens crops in greenhouses like this one at Koppert Kress. Grower and owner, Rob Bond.
I can't use chemicals. I supply restaurants. I have unique products where you don't get certification to spray chemicals, and I don't want it.
A Dutch startup, Pat's Drones, designed a flying robot inspired by students who wanted a way to kill mosquitoes. The system uses a stereo vision camera to pinpoint the moth and drone's position. Chief Technology Officer Kevin Van Hecke explains.
So it sees a moth flying by, it knows where the drone is because it's there, and then it just directs the drone towards the moth. And it has to do that in a super, super fast fashion.
Back at Koppert Kress, Bond says the hunter drone knows which insects to attack and which to leave alone. Bond says that just one moth can cost him 10,000 euros of damage, so he welcomes the security of a flying drone. The United Nations estimates that pests destroy between 20 and 40% of global crop production each year. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great day.